Today's Teisho will be on Case 8 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 8 is entitled Keichu, the Wheelmaker. Getan Osho said, Keichu, the first wheelmaker, made a cart whose spokes had made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Keichu, the first wheelmaker, made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Now, suppose you took a cart and removed both the wheels and the axle. What would you have? Mumon's comment, if anyone can directly master this topic, his eyes will be like a shooting star, his spirit like a flash of lightning. Mumon's verse, when the spiritual wheel turns, even the master fails to follow them. They travel in all directions, above and below, north, south, east, and west. So, I want to thank everybody for coming here to sit this morning. This is the beginning of a new year, and this is a wonderful way to start the year. Wonderful way to change your life, you know, by practicing Zazen. This is a story about a person named Keichu, who is like an ancestral inventor, you could say, a little bit like Icarus in the Western tradition. This is somebody who, or Daedalus in the Western tradition, this is somebody who is like the inventor. Daedalus in our tradition, Keichu is like the primordial inventor. So Keichu, the primordial inventor, made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. So you can visualize that cart. Then the question is, now suppose you took that cart and you removed the wheels and the axles, what then? So, you know, the koans are intended to be processed in a special way. So if you're interested in this koan, if you someday I hope we will have a chance to work on this koan together, you basically sit down on the cushion, you watch the breath until your mind becomes stable and calm, and then eventually you're going to enter into kind of samadhi state, a state of absorption in the moment. And ideally, your mind would be in a kind of blank state. This is the samadhi of mushin, the samadhi of shunyata, or emptiness. So you're on the cushion, you're watching the breath, you have moments where your mind is empty or blank, and you internalize the koan. So in this case, you could take a phrase from the koan, and it would be something like wheel or cart, something. Either of those would work. And your discriminating mind, your intellectual mind, is quiet. And you just keep repeating this key word or turning phrase. And your mind is unconsciously processing. The idea is that your mind will be unconsciously processing the koan. So there's not much of a story in this koan. In some of the koans, there's a story, and it can be very elaborate. There's a great inventor. He makes the first cart. And you can visualize this cart or like a chariot. You could imagine this as a chariot, you know, beautiful. If you've ever been to the museum, you've seen chariots, sometimes Egyptian chariots at the museum. You can see one in the Metropolitan in New York. It's so beautiful. You know, the design is so elegant, and they look so light. You know, it's the very essence of speed. You know, the Egyptians were such good chariot makers that with very economical use of materials, they could come up with very sturdy transportation. And these carts that you go to the Met and you see the Egyptian chariot, you know, it's really quite impressive. And you look at the wheels, and they're beautiful wheels. You know, they have spokes just like in the Quechua koan. And they have gold leaf on them. Beautiful. And you could imagine this cart being hooked up to a fast horse or a couple of fast horses. And you could just run like the wind. You know, you could get in your cart or in your chariot and just take off. And imagine what that was like. You know, we ride cars, but imagine what it would be like to sit in a chariot with strong horses pulling, running fast, and just driving through a field or over like a beach, like sand, you know. You would feel like, you know, you were the wind itself. That kind of freedom is so wonderful, right? You know, I am not really a big car fan, not really a big car fan, but I like bikes. And sometimes when I ride my bike on the canal over near Lambertville, you know, if there's not anybody on the canal, you can really open up, you know, on the Delaware. And you can just, you can go, you know, if you can do it, you can do 60 miles an hour on your bike. It's a straight shot. There's often nobody else on the path. And you can just open up. And if you're in the groove, you know, it's this, you're the very soul of speed. And it's so freeing, right, to be able to move like that. So, you know, the koan is inviting you to sort of internalize this idea. You know, the cart is what is a symbol of movement, of freedom, of travel. You know, travel. How wonderful that is. Some people really love to travel. They're so restless. Like Basho in Japanese tradition. And he could hardly stay in his house. When Basho would have to stay somewhere, he would get depressed. He had to be on the road. So if you've ever read The Narrow Road to the Deep North, his beautiful book of prose and poetry, you know, he talks about getting restless and beginning to obsess. You know, he would get trapped in these mental loops. Probably Basho actually suffered from depression, I think. And Basho could only get out of his depression by getting on the road. You know, and he'd hit the road and start making trips through Japan, usually to pilgrimage sites. And he found it so liberating just to put one foot in front of another and to go forward, right? Move. So, you know, if you work with this koan, I'm sure you'll appreciate the power of freedom to travel, to be free, to go. You know, we all love that freedom. The koan is saying something else, though, too. He says, imagine that. You know, imagine that chariot. Now take the wheels and the axle off, and what have you got? And probably, you know, if you contemplate that for a while, it may be make you sad. You know, make you sad. If you sit with that koan, you know, this beautiful cart, this beautiful chariot that can go places and move and travel. And now, you know, the wheels are off and the axle is off. It's just sitting there on the ground. You know, the horses can't pull it. And you know, this koan is sort of asking you to sit with that, to be in deep mushin, to be in deep samadhi, and sit with that situation, that situation. You know, sometimes koans, often koans are very difficult to work with. And it's not just that it's hard to sit for long periods of time. You know, sometimes koans are pointing us to things that are difficult to deal with, difficult to deal with. And they're asking us to process these things that are difficult to deal with on a deeper level than ordinary thinking. Recently, you know, we weren't originally scheduled to have this sit today. We were all supposed to be, or many of us were supposed to be, in Murray Grove having our sesshin, our winter sesshin. And at the very last minute, the sesshin was canceled. And I know that some people were really looking forward to this sesshin. Somebody I know told me that it's hard for him sometimes to come to sesshin. He knows that I talk about sesshin all the time. I say sesshin is the heart of Zen practice. And so he sometimes drags himself to sesshin. And he said there are times when hearing that the sesshin was canceled would have felt like that, you know, when you were a kid in school, and they say it's snowing and school is closed. It's like a snow day, right? Ah, sesshin canceled. Wow, great. But on the other hand, you know, there are people who were really waiting for this. There are people who, people other than me, who are really waiting for this. Who are counting the days to sesshin, you know. And people were thinking, you know, I can't, this is going to be very important, I want to do this. And then at the, you know, you're building up your momentum. You're, it's like taking a running jump, right? And you're, okay, I'm going to go to sesshin. Okay. I've cleared my schedule. You know, all of these things are lining up, and you're about to take your running jump, in, and it's like it, just before you jump over that line, you stop. You know? And that's very frustrating. That can be very frustrating. It might not be sesshin. It might be something else. You know, maybe you're counting on a grant, and it doesn't come through. There's so many ways in life to get trapped, right? There's so many ways in life to get trapped. You know, we all have ways of being, of grinding to a halt, you know? We all have our own ways of grinding to a halt. And our own experiences of being, of grinding to a halt, being stuck, being stuck. Sometimes when we're working on koans, we're stuck, right? You go into the Dokusan room and you talk to the teacher and you just can't seem to crack this koan. And that is such a frustrating experience. But there are many other such experiences in life. You know, I had a good friend, and she's quite a bit younger than I am. And, you know, I don't want to give too many details, but she wanted, you know, more than anything else, really, to have a happy, to get married and have a happy marriage. And because her own childhood had, there'd been divorce and a lot of instability, she really imagined that, you know, if she could just, you know, find the right person, life was going to be wonderful. And I know her very, very well. And she would, well, why don't I tell the truth? This is my sister, okay. Because it just becomes more and more elaborate, and I can't keep covering my tracks. You know? So anyway, my sister, who I love quite a bit, and who is 7 years younger than I am, so we're there's quite a distance between the two of us. You know, she wanted to have the happy family life that basically we didn't get. And so she was, you know, basically, she's a wonderful person. She's a nurse practitioner, and she works in an oncology ward, if you can imagine that. I just admire my sister so much. She deals with people who are dying primarily. You know, that's her life, basically, her life's work. And she helps them to feel comfortable, and she's one of the most caring people I have ever met. And it seems fair that she would be able to find somebody who would, you know, with whom she could have a satisfying relationship. So, you know, she would go out looking, you know, basically dating and meeting men, and she kept meeting these men who were, you know, really the wrong guy. You know, this is the wrong, you know, she would, you know, date this person, and, you know, basically he would cheat on her. You know, and then she wouldn't break it off, And then she'd get finally break it off, and then she'd have another boyfriend, and he would cheat on her. And, and my brother and I would just watch this with, like, horror. It was watching, like, one car accident after another. And Laura would bring home her new boyfriend, and we were just like, you know, it was like, don't tell me, you know, he's cheating on you, you know. And you know, clearly there was something going on psychologically, right? She was attracted to a certain kind of person. Maybe, you know, like my father cheated on my mother, so maybe she's looking for somebody like my dad, you know, and finding that person all over the place. And repeating, you know. And my brother and I would just shake our heads, you know, just if only Laura could find this, you know. And for a long time, she was stuck, repeating, you know. You know, eventually, she actually found somebody who is a wonderful person, and her current husband, with whom she's been married for a long time, and she has two lovely children, and it's a wonderful scene. You know, she finally found, but she finally got out of that. But for a long time, she was stuck, right? Stuck in this repetitive behavior, looking, finding the wrong person, looking, finding the wrong person, and just could not get out. And there are many cases of this, of people who just, you get stuck in life, you know. I have a friend of mine who is, who's basically a sort of mid-career professor, you know. And very unhappy with his life, you know. I saw him in the parking lot one day, and I said, you know, it was the beginning of the school year, and I said, hey, how's it going? And he goes, oh, brother. Back again, you know. It's like the old rat race, you know. And you know, I like this guy, and I feel sorry for his sorrow. You know, I'm sorry that he's so unhappy, you know. And I've known he feels this way for a long time. So he comes back to school. You know, if you think about it, being a professor could be one of the best things in the world, really. It could be one of the best jobs. You know, you could teach anything you want, basically, in your field. You can read new things and teach that. You can create new courses. You know, it doesn't have to be an ordeal. You know, you could actually be excited about it, you know. But he's not. You know, he comes back to school, and this is just torture for him. You know, it's like, oh, brother, back to the, you know, the grind, you know, another class, you know, another student, you know. And this, he carries this with, you know, it's easy if you're not in his head to see he's stuck, right? He's stuck. But he can't get out of it, right? He's repeating some kind of behavior that he can't get out of. Maybe he's so afraid of not being good that he's trying to distance himself from the possibility of failing, you know? So he's sort of preemptively making all of this valueless. Or maybe he has a dream, you know? Maybe he wanted to be a great literary critic, you know? And he's not. And so he feels like, you know, only losers are interested in teaching or something like that. You know, there's probably something like that he's carrying around. But he's stuck, right? Stuck. You know, I've known other people who are stuck in different ways. You know, my cousin married a very nice man, and he's a really lovely human being. And they had a little child who was severely deformed, right? And you know, who knows how it happened? You know, my uncle used to own a gas stations. You know, he owned a bunch of gas stations up near Maplewood. And my cousin used to work in the gas stations in the summer. And you know, I hate to think about it, but it's possible. You know, being around that gas wasn't good for her when she was pregnant. You know. But she had a little boy who was, you know, seriously deformed. And, you know, she's had to take care of this child all her life. And, you know, you can imagine what that's like, you know. she basically, your child never grows up. It's always needing your attention. And, you know, this is the situation. It's very labor intensive. And I know a little bit what that's like because a few years ago, my wife and I took care of her father, who was 90, and who needed, like, constant care, right? And the first thing I would do in the morning when I get up is to go down and see how Jack is and see if he's okay. And he was a charming guy, but you could never quite relax because you were always, at the back of your mind, you're always watching this guy. And sometimes I would come to sit and I would go straight home. And a lot of the time, we would just be at home because we couldn't get somebody to come and take care of Jack. And we felt stuck. It felt stuck. So there's lots of ways to feel stuck in life. And you just keep going back and circling back into the same patterns. This happens to all of us. This happens to all of us. In Zen ritual, when we eat, you'll notice that one of the things we do is to take a plate and we send it down the aisle, down the rows, and people take a little bit of rice or a little bit of their food and put it on the plate. At the end of the, we also take the wastewater, we also put our wastewater in a bowl. Technically, those food offerings and that wastewater should be taken outside and put someplace. And you might ask yourself, what are those for? Those are said to be for the hungry ghosts. In Buddhist mythology, there's this concept of something called a preta. The preta are hungry ghosts. These are beings who have died, but they can't go on to their next life. There's a whole mythology about these poor creatures because some of them are constantly hungry. And they want food, but they can't eat. And in some versions of this mythology, they can't eat because their mouths are too small, And basically, the preta are beings who are stuck between one life and the next. They're stuck, yes? And they're stuck because they can't free themselves from their, what shall we say? They can't free themselves from their unmet needs. See, in a way, we've all been preta, yes? We've all been these beings who are stuck and can't go on to our next life because we have these unmet needs that didn't get met in our last one. And so we're trapped in a kind of limbo, wishing we had this, and didn't get it. And looking, basically backward and unable to move forward with our life, yeah? So this ritual of leaving food for the hungry ghosts is actually very profound psychologically, very profound acknowledgement that all around us our fellow people have gotten stuck. So very, very profound teaching, I think, in this idea of the preta. We've all been, sometimes we've all been like the gods, Sometimes we've all been like the gods, We've had this one, wonderful day, basically all the doors open for us. But sometimes we're stuck, So this koan is really pointing to something very profound, and we all get stuck in life. We all have things that happen to us. Sometimes we're planning to go to Sesshin, and the Sesshin closes, the Sesshin location closes, and you feel trapped or stuck, you're expecting that promotion and it doesn't come. You might have a boss who doesn't acknowledge your contribution, and yet you can't quit. There's not another job waiting in the wings, and this can really eat away at you, can really trouble you. Or, it also happens, people can be in relationships that are not rewarding or nurturing relationships. I was reading in the newspaper that they find that a fairly large number of couples, of married couples, are not happy, but they don't break up. And it's a fairly significant number. It's not, you know, 50% or something, but it's a significant, it's like 25% or something of couples. People are unhappy, but they stay together because they're afraid to leave the relationship, you know. So these people are like preta too, you know, in a certain way. And they're stuck, and that's a terrible situation to be in. You love the person perhaps, but they can't give you what you need, and you can't move on. You know, that's so typical. You know. So we don't like to think about human beings this way. We don't like to think of ourselves as creatures who are capable of being stuck. You know, when we fantasize about ourselves, we fantasize ourselves on the chariot. You know, we're on the chariot and we're riding those horses down the beach, and you know, the wind is blowing in our hair, and you know, we can move in the four directions easily with no obstructions. But you know, so often in life, that's just a fantasy, right? And so in a million different ways we can be stuck. And so the koan is really pointing us to something maybe we would not want to see. You know, what do you do when you're stuck? How do you get out of it? You know, how do you get out of it when there's no way to get out of it? There was a very famous Japanese Zen teacher named Shinichi Hisamatsu. And that was actually when he was a Zen teacher, and he used to say, "What can you do when there's nothing you can do?" That was his approach to Zen. What can you do when there's nothing you can do? Hisamatsu. That was how he taught, you know. And by the way, he was a teacher of Webb Roshi. He was one of the teachers of my teacher. So, you know, this is a really important point. We all get stuck. We get stuck in our Zen training. We get stuck in our life. How do we get out of it? You know, what do we do when we're trapped, when we're stuck? And being stuck is a very, very human situation. You know, the hungry, we don't want to acknowledge the hungry ghosts are us, but the hungry ghosts are us. You know, we are the preta, you know, unable to change because of our unmet needs. So, something you might not fully appreciate about Zen, you know, when Buddhism began, people thought of the Buddha as a historical person, But a number of practitioner philosophers, people who were deep meditators but also thinking a lot, began to question whether the Buddha was just, what it means to say the Buddha was just a person, right? What does it mean the Buddha is just a person? You know, the Buddha lived to be about 80 years old, and he had his Daikensho, his Great Awakening, when he was about 35. So this being, who is supposed to be the great Buddha of this current world, right, this great teacher, liberating teacher, who basically went through countless lives of faultless service to other human beings in order to wake up, woke up at the age of 35 and died around 80. So what this means is that Buddha was on earth for what? 45 years, or 35 years, right? Something like that. Or 80 years, but teaching for what? 45 years, something like that. So that makes no sense in a certain way, right? The Buddha, this being who's pivotal for all of time and so on, and so, lived for 80 years and taught for 35 years, and that was it. So there's like a window of 35 years, and that's the important... People began to think, well, that's crazy, you know. What was it about the Buddha that allowed him to wake up? And then they realized, you know, actually about the same time that they were asking this question, they began to think about Buddhism a little differently. They began to think about the mind a little differently. You know, this idea of the Buddha mind. Intrinsically, in all consciousness, there is a kind of consciousness which is awakened mind. See, so the Buddha is not just a historical person. He's a historical person who tapped into this consciousness, this Buddha mind. So there's many, many different forms of consciousness, but to the Zen way of thinking, or to the Mahayana way of thinking, underneath all these other different forms of consciousness, there's a kind of fundamental consciousness, which is awakened consciousness. And we call this Buddha mind. And encountering this Buddha mind is what we mean when we talk about enlightenment. Enlightenment. So the theory, you know, if you ever wonder what Zen is all about, the theory is that all of us have access to this Buddha mind. All of us have access to this already enlightened mind. So it's actually not true that when we do Zazen, we're trying to become enlightened. That is a misunderstanding of the practice. Already we possess this enlightened mind. The problem is, you know, we block it. We close it off. And so all of Zazen could be understood as clearing away obstacles until we can clear away, and then get to this sort of root consciousness, this fundamental consciousness, which is enlightened mind. And so Zazen is all about sitting on the cushion and clearing away our obstacles, right? And getting in touch with this fundamentally radiant, compassionate, boundaryless intelligence, which we call enlightened mind, or Buddha mind, or enlightenment. Yeah? So, you know, this is a wonderful idea. This is a wonderful idea. Wonderful. But, and it's very appealing. You know, it's democratic. It has a lot to recommend it, you know. But you know, if you ask yourself, you know, do you have enlightened mind? Probably intellectually you would say yes, I buy this argument, you know. But existentially you probably don't think you have it. That's my guess. You know. So you know, the teaching is that we have enlightened mind, but the you know, existentially, personally, we often feel quite unworthy of that possibility, you know. And one of the reasons we might feel quite unworthy is because we're often trapped. You know, when we think of a Buddha, we think of this being who is at ease in the world, always compassionate. And when we look at ourselves, so much suffering, right? So much suffering. How far from that enlightened ideal are we sometimes? You know. And so you know, that gap can seem very great, very great. But the teaching of Zen is that, you know, if you just practice wholeheartedly, you know, you will liberate that energy and it will free you, you know, and you will be unstuck, you know. So doing Zazen, you know, sometimes people say, you know, misunderstand Zazen. You know, Zazen, some people think of as like, you know, strength of will. This is about being strong or having strength of will. And it is true. You know, Zen requires great determination. Great determination. There's no question about it. But, you know, actually, sitting on the cushion is just sitting on the cushion is such a wonderful act. You know, when we come into the Zendo, we bow to our cushions. And people think, what is that all about? You know, that's what a superstition or something. So important, right? Just sitting down on the cushion. Do you know you're expressing your trust in yourself, in your own Buddha mind. You know, just getting people to the cushion is hard. You know, people have a hard time just getting to the cushion. You know, you have no idea how many people come up to me at when we have these scheduled sits. And I'll say, how was your sit? And I'll say, good. And I'll say, do you practice at home? And they'll say, you know, I just can't. And you think, what is that all about, you know? That's psychologically so important that people can't sit on their own. I think it's my own personal interpretation. Feel free to, everything I say, just take with a giant grain of salt. But my read on that is, you know, we don't have a lot of confidence in ourselves. We don't have a lot of trust in life. You know, so you come to a place where there's formal sitting and everybody's showing some trust in this process, and you think, okay, I'll trust the process, you know. But just sitting on the cushion is such a momentous act. It seems so trivial. But you're saying, I trust this world. I trust this world. See, just sitting on the cushion says, I trust this world. I think it's so important. That's why we bow to our cushions. You know, this is like an emblem of our capacity to trust the world. You know, an expression of this is, and this is so powerful. This is so, just, Zen is all about learning how to trust. Everything in Zen goes on trust, goes on trust. So you sit down on the cushion, okay, I'll do it. You know, I'm sure I will never wake up, but let me just sit down and sit down. Now watch the breath. You know, oh, okay, I'm sure I will never, ever be able to get anywhere, but I'll watch the breath, you know. And so on. It's like one step at a time. It's like trusting, trusting. This is what it means to practice wholeheartedly. You know, we all have a certain, I think, just speaking for myself, we all have, existentially, we all have a sort of a low opinion of ourselves. I think that's true. And we all doubt very much that this thing called Buddha nature could be in us. And, you know, it's hard to get to the cushion because you think, well, what's the point? You know, what's the point of this, you know? But you sit down and you watch the breath, and then, you know, sometimes you feel better. You're in the moment. You feel the less obstructed, right? A little more open. You're calmer. You find, like, kind of like rising optimism. Like rising optimism, like rising sense of ease or a sense of connectedness. This happens sometimes, not always. But sometimes it happens, you know. And I think when we can get into samadhi, this is like a miracle, right? It's like we're cutting through all this cynicism and all this self-doubt and even like self-loathing, you know. And trusting enough to sit on the cushion, trusting enough to be with the breath, and then, you know, things keep opening up. They keep opening up. And one day, you're sitting on the cushion and your mind just goes blank. You know, just you suddenly encounter this blank mind. And, you know, often that's accompanied by feelings of elation or openness. You know, you can sometimes feel like energy flowing through your body, you know. It doesn't always happen, but it will never happen when you expect it. But if you just give up. You trust and give up. Trust and give up. Sit on the cushion, watch the breath, and try to have no expectations, you know. And sometimes wonderful things happen. And even if you have a quote-unquote rough sit, you know, your mind is a tempest-tossed sea of emotions and conflicting feelings, you know. Sometimes you get off the cushion, but you feel purified. You feel better, you know. And so, you know, this is, there's a rhythm to practice, which is, you know, working, you know, we have to sort of work through our doubts to get to the cushion, you know, work through our doubts in ourself and in the world, you know, you don't have to look very far to find reasons not to trust the universe, right? So getting to the cushion is itself this very important act of trust. And then, you know, every element of Zen practice requires that you trust, 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 you know. And as you do this, you know, you begin to find, I think you will begin to find that doors start opening up in yourself, you know. You know, in the verses that we recite every morning on Saturday and every morning in Sesshin, we say that, you know, we talk, there's a phrase in the verses on the heart mind that says, one with the trusting mind, one with the trusting mind. You know, this is so important. Those verses were written by a person named Seng Tsang, who basically is supposed to have had leprosy. You know, I always marvel at this. You know, this is a guy who had leprosy, and he wrote, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart." And it's all about, it's a big poem about trust. Yes? So, you know, how could this guy who had leprosy, who had every reason to feel that the universe had dealt him a bad hand, you know, write these beautiful verses about being one with the trusting mind, you know? But this, it takes a lot of work to get to that place where you can trust life to that degree. We have to take it like one step at a time. And you know, so getting to the cushion, watching the breath, you know, and little by little, you know, you become more open-hearted, more open-hearted. And, you know, often, you know, when we are in our everyday mind, it's a very defensive mentality. You know, being in our ordinary self is very defensive, very, you know, we've created a kind of a hard armor around ourselves to protect ourselves. And it's sort of an armor of cynicism or an armor of fear, anger, you know, many different things. You know, and we're safe inside that armor, but it's very claustrophobic, you know, and very kind of deadening, very deadening, you know. That's a little bit, it's another version of the chariot with no wheels, you know. When we practice Zazen, when we practice this way, this Zen way, and we take it one step at a time, and it's like trust this, you know, the world becomes a much bigger place. You know, we're not necessarily, when you're in deep samadhi, you're no longer experiencing things around you with reference to this small self. You're no longer, your normal consciousness, like everyday consciousness, is very much anchored into self. It's really like a defensive mentality. But, you know, if you like listening to music, you know, if you listen to music sometimes, you're no longer thinking about yourself. You're just becoming one with the music. Or if you like to go out into nature, you know, you're walking through the trees and you're not thinking about things. You know, you're just being one with the moment. That's like a bigger mind. You're not in the small self, that defensive self. And you're becoming one with the things around you. And, you know, the art of being free is moving from that defensive, self-centered mind to this bigger, trusting mind, which is, you know, really one with everything around it. That takes a lot of sitting to get there. But, you know, you can get there, you know, basically, if you take it one step at a time and you trust the process. And that goes for life, too. You know, life is also a process. I've talked about this before, but one of the really, I think, exemplary Zen figures in the 20th century was a woman named Jiyu Kennett. And Kennett was the first woman to be ordained as an Anglican minister in Great Britain. She wanted to become an ordained priest, I guess, in the Episcopal Church. I'd say priest. She wanted to be ordained, and they told her, no, you can't be ordained, you're a woman. And she fought and fought and fought, and she finally got ordained, but then she decided she wanted to be, she got interested in Zen. So she went to Japan, and she studied at a monastery in Japan. And all the monks, Japanese monks are actually very, 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 very sexist, extremely. The Japanese, I love many aspects of the Japanese, but one of the things that's not admirable about their culture is their sexism. And these monks really resented the fact, A, that this woman was a Westerner, and B, that she was a woman, and that she was being allowed to study like a male monk at this temple. And they would constantly try to screw her up, you know. So, you know, somebody would say, don't worry, I'll wake you up in time for the sutra recitation. But they wouldn't wake her up. And she'd wake up and hear the sutras and run down, and she was late. And, you know, the jikijitsu would scowl at her, you know, or the teacher would see her and she would feel ashamed. Or, you know, somebody would say, here's how you rake the leaves, you know. And she'd do it that way, and the, you know, basically the supervisor would come by and go, what are you doing? This is all wrong, you know. So, you know, people kept trying to trip her up and humiliate her, and she felt totally trapped, you know. And she went to see the Roshi, And she said, you know, I don't think I can take it anymore. And he said, everything is helping us to wake up. You know, everything is helping us to wake up. Everything is helping us to wake up. So, you know, if it's hard for humans to have that kind of trust, that advice is the advice of somebody who's struggled with his cynicism and self-doubt and self-loathing and et cetera, for maybe 50 years. But this is where you end up if you do a lot of zazen, right? And he said, everything is helping us to wake up. And even if you don't believe it, you know, if you act from that place, you can't go wrong. It's like everything is helping us to wake up. You know. And she did. She acted from that place. You know, and she finished her training. She came back to the United States. She started Shasta Abbey in California, a very successful Zen community. She developed a terrible disease. She went to the doctor, and the doctor said, you have 6 months to live. And about 37 years later, she died. Okay. So that's a trust, in a trusting mind in action. Kechu the Wheelmaker. Gitan Osho said, Kechu, the first wheelmaker, made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Now, suppose you took a cart and removed both the wheels and the axle. What would you have? Momon's comment, if anyone can directly master this topic, his eyes will be like a shooting star, his spirit like a flash of lightning. Momon's verse, when the spiritual wheels turn, even the master fails to follow them. They travel in all directions, above and below, north, south, east, and west.